Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is A.L. Press, an author and journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, and The Nation, among others. He was a 2011 Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the New American Foundation and the recipient of the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. He's the author of Absolute Convictions, and his latest book just out is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, A.L. Press.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And you start the book out describing one of the infinite number of horrors that took place during the Holocaust in Poland in 1942, where the Germans were just herding Jewish women and children into the woods and shooting them from dawn to dusk. And the soldiers were exhausted and drenched in blood. And the officer gave some of the soldiers the option of not having to participate in this extermination of human beings. And it sort of made me think, my God, you know, here we are today with a similar situation happening in Syria, in effect, where soldiers are being, arguably worse, soldiers are being asked to murder their fellow Syrians, and if they don't do it, they get a bullet in the head.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a fair point. And I think that I started the book. The book is, as you mentioned, about individuals who break ranks, whether that be soldiers caught in the midst of a war or at a massacre, or in the case of the final character in the book, a financial industry worker who engages undertakes an act of courage to speak out about wrongdoing and fraud. That opening story is the book opens on that, because when we think of those massacres that took place in places like Poland in 1942, we tend to think that there was no choice involved, these were low-ranking soldiers. They were in a totalitarian system. And so when they were told to shoot innocent people, they had to do it. And if anyone dared to not do it, they would be shot. What's remarkable about that story, and I'm not the first to tell it, it's from a remarkable book called Ordinary Men, but what's remarkable about the story is that before the massacre, the commander, as you mentioned, told the soldiers that any of the older men who did not want to participate could put their guns down. And some of them did do this, but not enough, of course, to stop the massacre from happening. But I froze that moment early in the book and set it up because I think that we need to reclaim the reality that even in situations of seemingly total conformity like that one, there are always some people who don't go along, and we need to know the stories of these people, not only because they remind us that there's more than one path, but also because we really can't judge, much less hold accountable, the conformists who did something we think is wrong. We can't really judge them if answer the claim that they were just doing what anyone in their shoes would have, unless we know the stories of those who found the courage to resist, and unless we tell those stories.
Just in terms of, though, of our collective conscience as a country, we're very much on trial every day, if you will, in a geopolitical sense. For example, the Iraq War, of course, was sold to us on moral grounds, that this terrible man had to be, Saddam Hussein had to be gotten rid of. And a lot of that was based on lies, which I think has done huge damage. And, of course, the torture that ensued with Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib has done untold damage to the reputation of this country, because dictators now can say, well, we're free to torture our people because the Americans do it. But we've gone through something of a national debate over intervening in Libya, which the U.S. managed to sort of outsource to NATO. And now we have a situation where we're facing Syria, and people are being slaughtered by a government that is just appallingly brutal and basically trying to kill their people into submission while we stand on the sidelines. Now, the reason that I think, and of course you can go back to Milosevic, where Europe was revisiting the crimes of the Nazis. The crimes of the Nazis are the thing that inform us so much about the idea that there is a moral imperative to intervene and stop genocide. So how does your story relate to that broader picture? Because, as I say, both as individuals, we have to face these moral challenges, and as a country, we also have to face it.
Yeah. That's a complicated question. You know, the book, there's certainly an element to the book where I'm raising questions about society, and one of the most crucial questions that the book really ends on when I tell the story of this whistleblower is that we often think that that bad social blunders like the Iraq War or like the financial crisis of 2008, that these terrible blunders, which leave so much damage, happened because too few people who saw what was happening spoke out and said something and raised their voices and warned. That is true, largely speaking, but I think it's too easy and not wholly accurate. I think there's a deeper problem, which is that as a society, we do not listen to the people who do speak out. And it's quite striking if you go back and look at the financial companies that were engaging in all kinds of blatant wrongdoing, Countrywide, for example. Well, there was actually a whistleblower in Countrywide trying to draw attention to what was happening. She was recently profiled on 60 Minutes.
Right, and the Justice Department apparently still hasn't talked to her.
That's right. That's right. So it's a question of listening and the institutions that ought to be there to listen and don't. In the case of the story that I told, Stanford, well, we all read and heard about this Ponzi scheme after the financial crash.
You know, after Enron, yeah.
2008.
And after Enron, right.
But bear in mind, the character I wrote about wrote a letter to the SEC about what was happening at Stanford and saying in bold capital letters, this may be a massive Ponzi scheme in 2003.
This is
Layla Wilder.
Wilder,
yes.
Right.
And no one listened. And now you can say, well, okay, there are a lot of letters that come across the desk of folks working at the SEC. The same letter, by the way, was sent to various newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and others. You can say, well, okay, but these places are flooded with material every day, and a lot of things get overlooked. Well, Layla Wilder didn't just send this letter. She actually spoke on the phone with someone in the SEC in Texas. She made a personal appeal before an arbitration board. It's not as though people thought people had every reason to know and understand that this was actually an experienced broker inside the company saying these things, that she had been fired for no reason other than asking questions, and that she was very worried that a broader scandal was going on. Well, as I say, it was 5 years afterwards that Layla Wilder got a call one day from someone at the SEC who said, Ms. Wilder, we'd like to talk to you about a former employer of yours. And she said, let me guess, Stanford. And, you know, of course, instead of laughing, this made her want to tear her hair up, because it's the societal responsibility that I think we fail to listen to these voices. And indeed, if you look at the United States, the term whistleblowing was coined here. Studies show there are more whistleblowers here than in any other country. And yet the whistleblowers don't have much of an effect. And why don't they have much of an effect? I think it can be traced directly and clearly to the fact that we're too distracted and we don't listen, and the institutions that ought to be paying attention to the dissenting voices don't. And ironically, we all have an interest in that, but we don't do it enough.
it's pretty amazing to me, and I'm sure it is even more so to you, A.L. Press, that given your previous book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict that Divided America, where you tell the story of what happened to your father, Dr. Shalom Press, who, after his colleague Barnett Slepian, a gynecologist, was murdered by an assassin from Operation Rescue, they turned their targets to your father, and you had Operation Rescue people in protesting your home and your father's office, picketing his waiting room, and you growing up with all of this right in your face. And you've written about it, of course, and tried to understand what motivated the people to both kill a doctor and protest abortion. I mean, it seems to be front and center now in our political debate. I mean, maybe it didn't go away, but I find it extraordinary. What's your sense? I know I'm changing the subject a little bit.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I would say two things about that. I'm glad you brought those events up, because they do illustrate one thing that I touch on in the book, and it's important. We've talked a lot here about acts of conscience performed for admirable ends. But let's remember that the original notion of the voice of conscience was that this was the voice of God, that an individual was hearing the voice of God and telling them to do something that they believed they had to do. As various people who write about this, philosophers and so forth, have noted, and I quote Susan Sontag noting this, you know, that voice doesn't always tell you to do something admirable. And conscience alone can take various directions. So in the example of Operation Rescue, it brought people to blockade clinics to prevent women from reaching clinics, or in even more extreme cases, it led some zealots to decide that they had to pick up a gun and start shooting people. So conscience alone is not automatically something that one applauds, nor is resistance alone. What really means the moral content of that resistance. Having said all of that, we certainly have not ended the debate about women's choice and reproductive rights. And indeed, I'm quite astonished that back when I was writing that book, the issue was abortion, today, the issue is contraception and access to contraception. And to some extent, that just shows you that that the forces opposing women's rights are gaining and have been gaining.
Well, just in closing, I'm quoting your father, a gynecologist, who said at the time, "I respect people who are opposed to abortion. It's their view, their right, but it's unacceptable to me the way they're trying to impose it on other people." And that seems to be the heart of what's happening now. It's not this debate over contraception and the stand that's being taken in this so-called phony war on religion that's being ginned up at the moment. That's inherent in it.
Right. And it's the imposition on others that I think ultimately, having said what I said, and I believe it, that the debate in Washington, if you watch the Republican political debates, you would think that the country's all ready to ban the sale of the pill.
Sure. Well, just as your father was charged with infanticide last night, Newt Gingrich charged President Obama with infanticide.
Yes, that's true. I watched the debate and noted the ugly use of the an ugly and sloppy use of that term. But I will say this. I would not guess that position of rolling back access to contraception is going to get a Republican presidential candidate very far, including with Catholic voters, by the way. I mean, you've seen the polls, but the overwhelming majority of voters, women, Catholics, Jews, Christians, believe what, you know, has become a clear reality that, that this is that young people who are engaging in sexual activity ought to have access to contraception, and that, to pretend that we can just teach abstinence and solve the problem is, I think, a very dangerous and reckless way to go.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, A.L. Press.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with A.L. Press, an author and journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, and The Nation, among others. He was a 2011 Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation and the recipient of the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism. He's the author of Absolute Convictions, and his latest book just out is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the student loan racket.